First Samuel chapter 1. Now, there was a certain man of Ramatham Zophim of Mount Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuth, an Ephrathite. And he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other was Peniah. And Peniah had children, but Hannah had no children. And this man, that is Elkanah, went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priest of the Lord, were there. And when the time was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peniah his wife and to all of her sons and her daughters portions. But unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion, or a double portion, for he loved Hannah. But the Lord had closed up her womb. And her adversary also provoked her sore. The inference here is Peniah. Peniah, being her adversary, provoked her grievously, for to make her fret, because the Lord had closed up her womb. And as he, Elkanah, did so year by year, that is, going up to the house of the Lord, so year by year, Peniah provoked her. Therefore Hannah wept and did not eat. Then said Elkanah, her husband, to her, Hannah, why weepest thou, and why eatest thou not, and why is thy heart grieved? Am I not better to thee than 10 sons? So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh, and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon a seat by a post of the temple of the Lord, and she was in bitterness of soul, and prayed unto the Lord, and wept sore. And she vowed a vow, and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of thy handmaid and remember me, and not forget thy handmaid, but will give unto thee thy handmaid a man-child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. And it came to pass that as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli marked or watched her mouth. Now Hannah, she spake in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she was drunk. And Eli said unto her, how long wilt thou be drunken? Put away the wine from thee. And Hannah answered and said, no, my lord, I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Count not thy handmaid for a daughter of Baal, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto. And Eli answered and said, go in peace, and the God of Israel may grant to thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him. And she said, let thy handmaid find grace in thy sight. So the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. Well, 1 and 2 Samuel brings about many stories in the Bible that we are quick to be captivated by. I mean, there is a sense of romanticism, if you will, when you think about the stories contained within 1 and 2 Samuel. I mean, there's the boy named Samuel who heard the audible voice of God call him in the middle of the night, and how cool of a scene that is. And then we can't neglect the shepherd boy, David, who winds up killing a notorious enemy of Israel with just a slingshot and a stone. And then that same shepherd boy goes on later to become king of the entire nation. Of course, fixed between Samuel and David is a man named Saul, the one Israel first wanted to be their king, not because of humility or gentleness, but because of his power and stature. I mean, when you think about all the stories contained within 1 and 2 Samuel, the whole narrative, it's filled with twists and turns that honestly keep You're on the edge of your seat. It's why those of us who have grown up in church, we remember those stories in Sunday school or the children's church. Our minds often go back to these stories of David killing a bear with his hands or taking a slingshot and killing a Goliath. I mean, there's that romanticism to all the things that are unfolding in these two books. Now, I've entitled this series of studies through Samuel a Tale of Three Kings, because this is the historical narrative of how Israel became a monarchy. Of course, we have the first king in Saul. That was the king that Israel wanted. It was not the one that God had chosen. Now, we'll get to that when we come to that. God gave Saul to Israel because that's what they wanted, but it was not God's pick. And then you have the second king. It was God's pick. It was David, the man after God's own heart. But then we have this third king. And who is this third king mentioned in the book of Samuel? Well, the third king centers on the throne of Jesus Christ himself, the king whose reign will never end. In fact, it's in 2 Samuel chapter 7 that God promises to David that there would come a king who would sit on his throne who will reign forever and ever. And so while we'll study more intently Saul and David, really, this is a book about Jesus Christ and how Jesus Christ became king. Now, when we study the Bible, it is imperative that we approach the scriptures in the exact manner that the scriptures are presented to us. For example, right now we're studying Colossians on Sunday morning, but studying Colossians is different than how we will study Samuel. Because Colossians is a letter with action steps that are given to us for direct application. In fact, this Sunday morning, we'll talk about Paul and the prayer of the church family. And it's very simple and straightforward as he is instructing the church at Colossae so that we take that same application for the church at Laurel. Samuel's different. Samuel is a narrative. And while it may present the same truths that we see in a book like Colossians, it certainly presents those truths in a different literary framework. Now, the reason why I bring this up is because if we are not careful, many will teach Samuel or those stories about David and Goliath and Samuel hearing the voice in the middle of the night. We'll teach those things the same way that we teach an epistle. But we can't do that, because this is not a set of divine instructions for the church. This is a narrative, an historical story that unfolds for us how God fulfilled his sovereign plan to bring a Savior into the world. Now, there are lessons that we can learn from these historical figures that God has chosen to reveal to us. And the lessons will be clear as we study these things together, and we'll see some of them tonight. But I want you to keep in mind something extremely important. That these stories are not about you and I killing bears or slaying giants. And I think some of us preachers who grew up in our initial years and embarrassingly so may have preached those type of sermons even from this pulpit, it is important that we recognize that the narratives of the scripture is not necessarily to make divine application into our lives. That a 16-year-old boy took a rock and a slingshot and killed Goliath, and so I'm going to give you five giants that you need to slay in your life. No, when we do that, we are abusing the scripture. We are using it to teach something that God did not intend, because this is not meant for direct instruction. This is a narrative. And so we must learn the lessons, we must understand the things that God is trying to bring to our attention as he shows us historically how he brought a Savior into the world. And of course, the people with whom he chose to do that. I think about what Paul said of the Church of Rome. I think it was Romans 15, verse 3, verse 4. You might have to correct me if I'm wrong, but I know it's chapter 15, where Paul said that the things that were written aforetime, the things that were written previously in the Old Testament, they were written for our learning, that through patience and hope, we would have comfort from the Scriptures. And so, yes, there are things that we will learn, but this is about our comfort. This is about us knowing in hope how a Savior came into the world so that we can rightly affirm our faith in God's plan. Now, let me give you a little background about Samuel. This is not a peaceful season in the nation of Israel. In fact, this is a time of social, political, and religious chaos. Does it sound familiar? In fact, the very last verse of the last chapter of the book of Judges tells us exactly. In fact, just hold your finger there. It's only a few pages over. You got to only just go through Ruth and get to Judges chapter 21 and verse 25. You're going to see exactly how Israel is as far as their condition as Samuel begins to unfold. Look at it, Judges 21, 25. In those days, that is the days that we are going to study together. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Notice this, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. In those days, there was no leadership in Israel. There was no spiritual leadership in Israel. And as a result, every man did what they thought was their truth. Everybody did what was right in their own eyes. It's a chaotic time, socially, politically, religiously, and it summarizes not only the condition of Israel as we open up 1 Samuel, but it is a condition that is very much similar to the season in which you and I live as a people. I was thinking as we sang the song just a moment ago that Jesus is indeed the light in our darkness. He is the hope to the hopelessness around us. Our times are not much different than the times in which you and I are going to study over the next several months. Chaos, confusion. It's as if to wonder, where is God and does he have a plan to help us? But God is going to do what he has always done. As we study Samuel, he's going to bring about his purposes in a time where the majority of people have forgotten God, where the majority of people have lost their way. And he's going to begin that process through a family of nobodies. Nobodies. I mean, when you look at verse 1, I mean, it's actually kind of boring until you get to verse 2. Look at it. Open it back to 1 Samuel 1 and verse 1. Now, there was a certain man. It's kind of a unique way to identify someone if he was a somebody, right? Well, it's a certain man, just a man from Mount Ramatham, Zophim, over there near Mount Ephraim. His name was Elkanah. Well, what do we know about Elkanah? Well, he was the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuth, an Ephrathite. He's a nobody. And yet God is going to use the family of nobodies to accomplish his purpose. By the way, do you see a pattern of this in the Scriptures? Whether it be Moses, Samuel, John the Baptist, or even Jesus, these figures of great spiritual importance, they were all born in times of difficulty. So when things are chaotic around us, may we not lose hope in the reality that God is always at work behind the scenes, bringing about his desired outcome. As the book opens up, the focus is not on Elkanah necessarily. The focus is on a woman named Hannah, an extraordinary woman who had remarkable faith in God. But her story, however, begins with difficulty. I have 2 points to the scriptures that we'll study tonight. So if you write the first one down, let's just look together at Hannah's tears. Hannah's tears. Now, the scene begins with a significant problem. A problem that reveals the family was divided and seemingly dysfunctional. Look at it there in verse 2. We've learned who Elkanah is. He's a nobody that lives over there near Mount Ephraim. And here is the lineage from which he came from. And then you open up verse 2, and now it gets interesting. How does he open up verse 2? Here's what he says. And he, Elkanah, had 2 wives. One was named Hannah, and the other, Peniah. So what we have here is a family dynamic that is dysfunctional, but a family dynamic that God neither designed nor ever once commended. It does present a question, however, from time to time when we read scenes like this. What is the deal with all the polygamy in the Old Testament? That's a good question. I don't have time to dive into all the nuances of this, but since we are approaching it in our study, I think it's important to at least make a few comments here. And the first comment is simply that this arrangement, the arrangement of polygamy throughout the Old Testament, it was tolerated by God, but it was not created by God. And you don't have to go very far in the scriptures to understand that, because when you open up Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2, we understand right there in the beginning of the world, in the Garden of Eden, it is very clear. God created one man and one woman to live together forever in marriage. That is God's design. Not one man and 2 women, not one man and 10 women. One man and one woman. So God neither designed polygamy, nor did he ever commend it. In fact, polygamy in the scriptures is never one time presented in a favorable light. In fact, like our story before us, it most always is the backdrop of chaos. The backdrop of confusion. We learned that about Abraham and Sarah, how much of a dysfunctional family it was when he brought in another wife. We'll see it again tonight where Elkanah brings division and dysfunction in the family, confusion and chaos when he went outside of God's design for the family. Now, why would they do this? What prompted them to walk down the aisle more than once? Well, this culture in which we study in the Old Testament was one where having children not only provided economic stability, that is, in a world that is just developing, the more sons you had, the more workers you had, the more to be able to take care of the family business, the family land, so to speak, which meant the more children, the more workers, the more income. In fact, these Jewish patriarchs, they would look at the more children you have, the more security in old age that they would have as far as their children, taking care of them and making sure that their needs were met, as we do see throughout the Old Testament. Of course, there's the national-wide dynamic to this. The more sons you have, the larger your military would be built. And so having more children was a means of providing economic stability. But it also provided a good name, because both spiritually speaking and for the future lineage of the family, children was what made a man stand out in terms of his identity. After all, it was God who told the Jewish people that their responsibility was to get married and to be fruitful and multiply the earth. This was their responsibility. This was what God designed for them. It was a sign of spiritual blessing that a man's name would go on and on and on from generation to generation. So, if a man's first wife was barren and could not provide this economic stability or this good name that they desired as a culture, then what he would do is he would choose a second wife who could bear him children and carry on the needs that it would bring. And though God never approved of these decisions, this is what seems to be the reason why polygamy was frequently practiced. And perhaps in our context, why Elkanah has two wives. Again, one was Hannah, the other Peniah. Peniah had children, but Hannah had no children. It's very similar, I think, to the concept of divorce in the New Testament. When Jesus was speaking to the Pharisees about this, he said, this did not come from God. God only tolerated it because of what? The hardness of your heart. And so I think that's what we have in terms of polygamy in the Old Testament. This did not come from God. God did not approve it. He only tolerated it due to the hardness of the hearts of men, the depravity in which our fallen nature thinks. And we can only imagine the type of conflict that comes in a family dynamic such as this. To have more than one wife, fellas, ladies, to have to share your husband with another. I mean, think of the conflict that might have already been transpiring in Elkanah's home. You have Hannah, who is bearing this great burden of being unable to have children, which is having a significant emotional impact on her life, as it did all Hebrew women of this culture. Look at it in verse 7. It says that she wept and did not eat. Then said Elkanah, her husband, to her, Hannah, why are you weeping? Why are you not eating? Why is your heart grieved? And so on this side, you have Hannah, who wants to honor God by multiplying seed. She wants to cause her husband's significance by carrying on his name, but she is barren. She cannot do what she feels like she was born into the world to accomplish. I mean, to have no children was not only a personal disappointment, but to these women, it felt as if they were useless to God and dishonoring toward their husbands. Again, I remind you, in Deuteronomy chapter 7, we read about passages where the Bible teaches us that children were a sign of God's favor. The more children to have, the more you are viewed as being blessed by God. I do think there is a significant amendment to that as we live in this New Testament church age, that we must continue to carry on the purposes of marriage and not to desire children could be, by implication, that of obstinance against God's design for marriage. But we'll leave that for another time. To these women, this was personal and this was humiliating. It was a particularly heavy trial to live your life in a time and culture where you could have no children. So there's one side of the struggle. Then you have the other side, the other wife, Peniah, whose only purpose for even being into the family is to carry out childbirth. She was not Elkanah's first love, and she knew that his affection was not toward her. In other words, Peniah had his children, but Hannah had his heart. So this dysfunction created, no doubt, a lot of tension in the family. And we see some of that. Because when you read in verse number 4, we find out things like Elkanah, when he would go up once a year into Shiloh where the temple was, and they would offer sacrifices. And then after those sacrifices were made, they would go through the custom of having food and presenting it to the family. What we read here in verse 4 and 5 is that Elkanah would give more portion to Hannah than he did Peniah, even though Peniah actually had children to take care of. Look at it in verse 4. And when the time was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and her daughters portions. All right, for sake of just making this clear in our terms, let's look at it like this, all right? Peninnah got a scoop of mashed potatoes, all right? She got a scoop of mashed potatoes. Her son's got a scoop of mashed potatoes. Her daughter's got a scoop of mashed potatoes. But look at this in verse 5. But unto Hannah, he gave her two scoops of mashed potatoes. So what we have here is the blessings that come through this honorable worship and sacrifice. Peninnah is only getting half of what the one he truly loves is getting, even though she has zero children to take care of, and Peninnah has got her hands full. And as a result, Peninnah would grievously and relentlessly irritate Hannah, aggravate her, provoke her because of her barrenness. In fact, verse 6 says that she became an adversary to Hannah, mocking her, no doubt, as she lived her life without children, as she was going through this trial. It says she provoked her sore to the point that it made her fret. And why was she doing this? Not because she got two scoops of mashed potatoes, but because the Lord had closed her womb but opened up hers. The language here is as if Peninnah at all times of the day, throughout the week, year after year, would constantly rub this in her face. Oh, look at my children. Not only do I have children, but boy, aren't they good children. They're redheaded, curls, freckles, better than your kids. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. You don't have any kids. What in the world are you doing on this earth? You are a waste of life. We know that Yahweh wants us to bear children and multiply the earth. Why are you even breathing? You have no business being here. Sticking it to her. Rubbing it in. This went on and on and on. That is what is meant in verse 7 where it says, as often as Elkanah went to Shiloh, that is how often Peninnah would provoke her. And look at what happened in verse 7. She was so broken by the way that she was treated in her home that she couldn't even eat. And all she could do was cry. For these reasons that Hannah is weeping bitterly, grieving under the burden of this treatment that is so heavy to her. She can't even taste food. She can't even muster up enough joy to have a meal. Have you been there? I mean, maybe it was in relation to children, barrenness. Perhaps it's a whole other set of trials and mistreatment and afflictions that brought you to such brokenness that you couldn't even eat, no appetite. All you could do was cry. Can I go ahead and give us one of those lessons we need to learn? Here's one of the lessons we need to learn already, is that whether we intend to or not, our tongues can drive people into despair. Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you where all this is happening at the particular moment. It's happening in the house of God at Shiloh. I mean, of all places, the house of God. a place for people to walk in the doors and feel love and acceptance and hope and joy. Yet what is Hannah experiencing? She's experiencing distress and brokenness due to the weight of her trial. Read this and I thought about even our current circumstances with all that's going on in our nation, whether it has to do with social issues or health issues. But can I just remind us as members of Laurel Baptist Church that we need to be thoughtful of the afflictions of others. You may not know what it's like to have walked in their shoes and to experience the life that he is experiencing, but it gives you no right to mistreat someone or to draw some line of distinction against someone because of the afflictions you have not experienced yourself. We need to be sensitive with our words, compassionate in supporting the griefs of one another. When we walk in this door, we should not make people's burdens heavier. We should make them lighter. I just want to add a simple word of encouragement that if you're grieving right now through a season of trial, I just want to help you understand a very important theological distinction, and that is God has willed this for you. Did you notice that in verse 6? Look at it. Her adversary provoked her sore to make her fret because the Lord had closed up her womb. The Lord did this to Hannah. It's no fault of her own. No wrong in her. The Lord, for his divine purposes, closed up her womb. You say, Pastor, how in the world does that encourage me? Because in Hannah's case, think about this. If God is the one who closed the womb, then she knew that God is also the one who could open her womb. But even if he doesn't, there is peace in knowing that my life, even in the bad things, even in the difficult things, that my life, yes, even those difficulties, they contribute in the providence of God to the good things that God is bringing to pass around me. Now, when we come to verse 8, we have an interaction between Hannah and Elkanah that causes me to simply smile. Her husband approaches her sweetly about all of this grief, but he does it in a very manlike stupidity. Look at verse 8. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why are you crying? Why aren't you eating your dinner? Why is your heart grieved? I imagine Hannah might have said, I'm only speaking from experience to hear from this, that Hannah might have looked to him after these three questions and said, isn't it time for you to go out on your run? Why do you think I'm crying? Why do you think I'm not eating? What do you mean, why is my heart grieved? Go back outside. But here's where he really messes up. Look at the last part of verse 8. Am I not better to thee than 10 sons? He says, am I not worth more to you than 10 sons? So he asked questions he already knew the answers to, by the way. He knew why she was crying because he wouldn't have asked this final question had he not known the situation that was grieving her. He knew that she had been broken for years because of her barrenness. Now, he loved her. He's trying to make things better, but like most of us men do, we royally make things worse. He asked the wrong question. Am I not worth more to you than having children of your own? You know, what he should have asked, or what he should have said, rather, is that, Hannah, you are worth more to me than having 10 sons. Perhaps we'll save that for a marriage seminar later, another day. But it's a good reminder, ladies, and I mean this with all sincerity. It's a good reminder that even when your husband's words are well-meaning, but they end up being worthless, that there is always one whose comfort never fails nor errs. And we're afraid sometimes, even in our marriages, we look to our spouses as to be our Savior, Messiah. And there's only one who's our Savior, Messiah. It is Jesus. He can give you the comfort that you need. He will never say anything to irritate you. He knows exactly what to say. Now, make no mistake. Make no mistake. Don't think bad of Elkanah. I believe Elkanah loved her, and that is clearly evident here. He was trying his best to make a bad situation better, but in that we see our human frailties. We also see that even Hannah, her hope was not in her husband. Her hope was in her God. So we have Hannah's tears. Let's write down number two, Hannah's prayer. And very rarely do I get to a second point and I'm able to say, finally, Hannah's prayer. Now, whatever happened from verse 8 to verse 9, we do not know. All that is clear is that Hannah found a place of prayer. In fact, she was in the temple where Eli the priest was nearby. Take a look at what happens. Look at verse 9. So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh. Again, she's not eating. Peniah's eating. Peniah's boys and girls are eating. Elkanah is eating. Hannah's not eating. She's somewhere else. She's crying. Peniah has picked on her to the point that she just can't take it anymore. She needs to be by herself. So she's not even around the dinner table. And then Elkanah tries to make things better, and he makes things worse. She says, why don't you go out for your run? He goes out for his run, and she decides to get up and go try to make things better. So she rises up after they had eaten in Shiloh and after they had drunk. Now, Eli the priest sat upon a seat by the post of the temple of the Lord, and she was in bitterness. Now, not bitterness toward the Lord. It's a word that is speaking of the grief of her soul. She's grieving. She's broken. And so she begins to pray unto the Lord, weeping sorely. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou will indeed look on the affliction of thy handmaiden and remember me and not forget thy handmaid, but will give unto thy handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. This is her prayer. And there's a few things I want you to write down about her prayer, okay? Number one, she did not complain to the Lord about her situation. You don't see that. Not uttering one complaint to God. No, woe is me. Peniah's picking on me again. Lord, I can't stand being in this house that you've put me in. I mean, every morning I get up and I see the children and I hear the children and Peniah's rubbing it in my face and my husband don't even know the right thing to say to me. Lord, my life is messed up. What have you done to me? It's not what we read at all. She doesn't complain to the Lord about her situation. Write down number two. She did not demand God to take vengeance on Peniah. You don't see that either. She doesn't demand God to take vengeance on Peniah, as we often see in the imprecatory prayers of the book of Psalms. Lord, may your wrath rain down fire upon my enemies, that they will smell like charcoal. She's not asking God to wipe Peniah out, to give her some disease that she'll never wake up from. She's not demanding God take vengeance on Peniah. Number three, she was not afraid to ask God to change her circumstances. She was not afraid to ask God to change her circumstances. Now, this is important. Well, sometimes we think about the sovereignty of God and his choices and how it was the Lord who closed up her womb. It was the Lord who did this in his sovereign divine choosing. So does that mean when the Lord has done something that I'm just to sit back and just accept it? I don't think that's what it means at all. We're not to fight against it, and that's not what she's doing here. She's doing what God invites us to do. to ask of him to change our circumstances. And I think this is important because it does not mean that Hannah was not resting in God's sovereignty. We will see momentarily that she indeed was at peace with whatever God chose for her life. But she also knew that God honored folks when we put our faith in his authority and power. She knew that God invites us to come to him and ask him to change our circumstances. In fact, Richard Phillips says it much better than I do. Let me read it to you right from his sermon on this passage. He said, God is pleased to act in response to our prayers. Some people react to the knowledge of God's sovereignty by thinking that prayer, therefore, does not matter, since God has decided anything and everything in advance. But Hannah did not reason this way. She understood that God's sovereign will is achieved through the acts of men and women, especially our prayer. That faith in God leads us in our troubles to pray to that God who is also sovereign over all things. And I think this is important. That while we recognize God's sovereignty, it does not mean he refuses to hear from us. No, he invites us to come to him, to ask, to seek, to knock, to put our faith in him in such a way that it would change our circumstances. She was not afraid to ask God to do that. I wrote down number four here. She prayed with a pure and holy motive that put God's will first. She prayed with a pure and holy motive that put God's will first. Now, just let me mention this quickly. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. We're actually going to get to this next week. But at the end of verse number 11, she says to the Lord that if you give me a son, I promise you that no razor will ever come upon his head. This seems like a strange thing to say, doesn't it? I mean, obviously, Simon's mom prayed that, and it did not work, but this whole idea, what does that mean? You give me a son, and I'll never take him to the barbershop? What's going on here? Now, this is a reference to the Nazarite vow. And again, we're going to come and I'm going to explain this much more detail to you next Wednesday. But understand this. What she's saying here is more than just a Sunday morning service of prayer and baby dedication that we're accustomed to when we read this passage of Hannah coming to the temple of the Lord to present her child to God. What we do is a misrepresentation of what was actually taking place. She wasn't coming to the temple to give her child to God and for them to pray over it, and then the child goes back to Hannah and Elkanah, and then they go back home and do their thing. No, that's not what's happening at all. No, she is promising to God to literally give her son away. She's saying, Lord, if you give me a son, I will give him to you for the service of the temple as an offering back to the Lord. In other words, after the child would be weaned by her, he would not be raised by her. He's saying, you give me a child, I'll give him back to you so that Eli, the priest, can raise him to fulfill your purpose for his life. So don't read this as if Hannah's making a bargaining chip. Lord, give me a child and I'll dedicate him to you. No. This was a genuine desire for her child to be fully committed to God's kingdom. You give me a child, Lord, and then after he is weaned, I will bring him to Eli, to the temple of God, and I will leave him there, and he will be trained and dedicated and set aside for the work of priestly service. And Elkanah and I will go back home. How about that? Her prayer was purely motivated. Then write down number five. She did not offer her prayer to God casually. She did not offer her prayer to God casually. In fact, verse 15 says at the end of the verse that she was pouring out her soul before the Lord. So she's pouring everything she has out, emotionally, spiritually, mentally, physically. She is coming to God, begging him to change her circumstances. Now, I got to wrap this up. I told you at the beginning, Israel is in chaos, and part of this chaos was that their spiritual leadership was lacking. And we get a hint of that already before we're ever out of chapter 1. Look what happens after she's praying. Verse 12 says, "It came to pass that as she continued praying before the Lord, Eli's watching her mouth. Now Hannah, she spake in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard." You understand what he's saying here? Is that... It would be like you seeing somebody doing this. You know, if you walked into the living room, Lisa, and one of your girls is just standing there, you're like, "What is wrong with Addison? She has gone crazy. She's talking to herself, but she's not even saying anything." This is the scene. She's moving her lips, but nothing is being heard. She's only praying in her heart. So what does Eli do? This is despicable. This is the spiritual leadership of Israel right now. Eli thinks that she's drunk. And he says to her in verse 14, "How long will you be drunk? Put away your wine." Hannah said, "I'm not drunk. I'm just broken. I'm sorrowful. I've not touched wine or strong drink. I haven't even eaten for that matter. I am just pouring my heart out to God. Don't think me to be a daughter of Baal, carnal, wicked, ungodly. No, no, no. I'm praying out of the abundance of my grief." John Woodhouse said it like this: "If Israel had a leader who could not tell the difference between a godly woman's heartfelt prayer and a drunken stupor, then no wonder Israel had a leadership crisis." Of course, Eli, when he heard Hannah's explanation, he did give her a blessing. Look at it, verse 17. "Eli answered and said, Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that you have asked of him. And she said, Let thy handmaid find grace in thy sight. So the woman went her way, did eat, and her countenance was no more sad." So Eli saying this would be equivalent to me saying to you, I'm praying that God's will be done in your life. You bring the request to me, and I will pray with you that God's will be done in your life. That's what Eli's saying to her. I'm sorry, I thought you were drunken. Pardon my ignorance. I will pray for God's grace and mercy to meet you where you are. But did you notice what happened? Her appetite returned in verse 18. And her countenance changed. Not after she received an answer, but before she received an answer. She doesn't know whether or not she's going to have a baby. She doesn't know whether or not God is going to answer her cry. But her prayer changed her. It brought her soul from grief to rest, from brokenness to peace. Why? Because she went into the presence of God. It's a great reminder that prayer is not about getting my will done on earth. Prayer is about getting me into agreement with God's will in heaven, whatever that may be for my life. The order is extremely important, Christian. She doesn't pray, get pregnant, and then have joy. You follow me? She doesn't pray, get pregnant, and have joy. No, she prays, has joy. Spoiler alert, she gets pregnant. Write these two things down and we're done. Number one, prayer does change things. Hannah's prayer will change her life. Hannah's prayer will change her nation. And Hannah's prayer is going to change the history of the world. Prayer does change things. Yes, God is sovereign. Whatever's going on around us, look, whatever's going around us, God has willed this. But it doesn't mean he wants us to sit by and say nothing to him. No, he wants us to come and in pure holiness and in pure motive beg him to change our circumstances. Prayer does change things. Number two, prayer also changes me. In fact, first and foremost, prayer changes me. Hannah entered into prayer depressed, but she came out of that season of prayer with joy and with peace. Why do you need to pray? It's not so much about your circumstances changing, it is about you changing. Are you frustrated? You look at the things around our world and you get aggravated by every decision made, every possible move that might be coming in front of you. Can I ask you a question? Are you praying or are you just scrolling? Because regardless of what's going on outside the walls of this body, prayer changes me. Are you carrying a burden, a trial, affliction? You're broken to the point that you can't even eat. Let me tell you how to get your appetite back. Pray. Let prayer change you. Of course, it's always important to point out that God sometimes chooses not to answer our prayers. Why? Because He knows that to do so would be harmful to us, harmful to others, and frankly, harmful to His purposes. So we must let prayer change us, and then let God change our circumstances, if it so be that it is His will. Let's stand together for prayer.